Hello and welcome to Brand Game Strong. I am Mitali and back with another guest episode. I bet you didn't think I'd be back so soon, but here we are. And before we go into our episode today, I just wanted to kind of just check in with you. How are you doing? I've spoken to quite a few friends who are going through various transitions at the moment. So I feel like it's a period of change. Maybe it's because, you know, we're approaching September, and September usually is the time for a fresh start. I know that in the medic world in the UK, a lot of medics are kind of now changing their placements and they're going into like the next year of their job, or they're taking breaks. New doctors are starting their careers. So it's all very exciting. In the corporate world, I'm definitely speaking to people who are changing roles, maybe changing companies as well, maybe deciding to take a break for a while. And it's all very positive. I feel like everyone's kind of gained a bit more perspective and is actually trying to focus on the things that really matter to them. And, you know, I just want to say that if you are feeling a little bit stuck on that front, then I would definitely encourage taking a small risk, take a calculated risk, make a plan for what you want to do. You know, it doesn't have to be immediate. It could be in 6 months. It could be this time next year. Just having that thing to work towards, I feel like just gives so much motivation, momentum, energy, and positive vibes overall. And also summer can be a time where like motivation can be lacking a little bit just because everyone's like in summer holiday mode. And also seeing loads of people traveling, definitely think about what you want from your life. And it's something that I did back in December, and I'm really, really pleased because now I'm in my career break and just really excited to be spending this time, you know, just working on creative stuff, just even if it means doing nothing for a few hours or a few days and just letting my brain marinate in just the nothingness. That's sometimes the best way to bring creativity and new ideas forward and just bring a fresh perspective. So yeah, moving on. So our guest today is Henika Patel. And if you don't know her, come out of your rock. Seriously, come out. It's okay. It's not scary. Just come out of your rock because she is amazing and she has grown so much. Like even in the time that I've known her, which has been like a year, I came across her page while scrolling on the Brand Game Strong page actually. And I just found it amazing how she was breaking down misconceptions around yoga and tantra, which I didn't even know what tantra was. And the only thing I'd heard about tantra was from American Pie, and it was all very, very sexual. And it was just like, you know, the more you listen to Henika talk about these ancient Indian art forms, the more you realize that there is so much more to these things. And I feel like a lot of it gets lost in translation when it's brought to the West. So yeah, it's all things ancient art and cultural appropriation and just discussing what tantra and yoga means and why she made the transition from a corporate role into this. Which is really interesting, I think, for anybody who is kind of in the corporate space, but also interested in these art forms and maybe wondering how to get more involved in that. And a huge theme that comes up in this episode is this idea of taking a plunge, having a bit of faith. And Henika actually went traveling, and I loved picking her brain a little bit about what her experience was like traveling the world. Honestly, like as a South Asian female, it is just so unheard of. Or like very, very uncommon, I'd say still, because there's so much fear that, you know, the older generation have around just letting their daughter roam free because, oh my God, she's a woman and, you know, what would happen to her. But honestly, listen to it. It's such an inspiration for so many women who are maybe holding back from traveling or going alone, you know, somewhere unknown, not knowing anybody. Also just making a change in their careers as well and breaking up with their salaries. That's a huge topic that also comes up. So yeah, I mean, it's a bit, I've explained it kind of badly today, but I am still very, 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 very excited to bring this episode to you. It's been sitting on my computer for a few months. So that is a disclaimer. And since then, Henika has actually launched her own business. It is an organization called School of Sensual Arts, or SOSA for short. They are leading the sensual revolution, and by translating ancient wisdom for the modern world, they are weaving together yoga and tantra into sensory experiences to share with incredible souls from around the world. In an age of increasing isolation, they want to inspire you to connect deeply, express freely, love intimately, and lean into your desires and lead life by the heart. How beautiful is that? And Henneke actually runs regular women's circles, which are aligned with the lunar cycle. And I've attended two of them now, and I've loved my experience at these women's circles because I just feel like they're such accepting spaces. And one thing we speak about is the fact that it just felt so natural to come in this circle and just have these deep conversations about how we've been feeling and our insecurities and what we've been learning and overcoming. And I'm definitely going to keep going back to it whenever I'm feeling like I need a bit of a booster of energy, you know, and motivation. And she also runs couples workshops specifically around Tantra and improving your intimate life with your partner, but not in the way that you think. It's more from like a mind, body, soul connection, which is very cool. All the links will be in the description of the episode, so you can find her there. And I think I've been going on for a very long time, so let's get into the episode. And I hope you learn something, and I hope you enjoy and take something positive out of this next hour or so. Hello, Henneke. Welcome to Brown Game Strong.
Hi.
I'm so happy to have you on. Just mind blown by all the work that you're doing. So I'm really glad that you're here today and can't wait to dive into the discussions. How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and looking forward to speaking to you because I've been following your work for a while now and just really resonate with your audience and can't wait to connect with you and them through this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just so amazing, right? Being able to connect with people that we may never have crossed paths with just due to like mutual interests, or maybe just the algorithm like showing each other's pages coming up.
It's like the slowing down of this year has actually allowed us to even have space to make those connections. Because I think, you know, in the absence of the daily connections, which we usually have, even the small ones that we have in passing with people, you know, we're seeking these deeper connections now, which God thank the algorithm in those cases, because they really do bring you to they bring you to people that you connect with on a level that maybe you don't have in your like closer friendship network. And that's so useful. It's so inspiring. And, you know, they say that you're the product of like the five people that you hang around most, aren't they? And it's like sometimes you make connections on social media, but you speak to them almost every day. Like, you may have never met them in person, but you speak to them every day and you do become inspired by them. And that's the pro, I think.
Absolutely.
It can go both ways.
Yeah.
It can also go the other way.
Definitely. I think conscious use of it is very important. I wanted to ask you, how have the past few months been for you?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question, because it's been a really different year for everyone, for all, you know, manner of reasons. And for me, it's been a year of real change. Again, I think this is echoed in like the wider consciousness. But last year, I moved back to England. I was living in China. So I moved back actually before this happened. And so this year, I've been just staying with my family, reconnecting with my family, because I was away from the country for 5 to 6 years. And so this year's really allowed me to spend a lot more time with them with the lockdown. And of course, that's meant a huge transition in the way that I work. So whereas before, you know, all of my classes and my teachings were in person, now they are all online, like every single one. So it's been a huge transition in that way. But it's actually, you know, it's allowed me to connect with people all over the world, which I would never have been able to connect with. Which is incredible, which is absolutely incredible. I would never have imagined it if it wasn't for the situation that that my work would reach that far, really. So I'm grateful for that, but I do value that it has been, you know, a really difficult year for some as well.
I resonate with that, with just the whole idea of it being the yin and yang of it, which I want to talk to you about, because I
was so excited to join your women's circle last night. I just thought it was so beautiful. And actually, over lockdown, one thing I've been doing quite a lot is listening to podcasts. And I try and just gather information from other ones. And there's so much wisdom shared. And I think the idea of yin and yang was something that really came up in one of the episodes I listened to. And it talked about how this, you know, this idea of like masculine and feminine energy. Can you tell us a little bit more about your understanding of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the yin energy, this is the passive energy. This is the feminine energy. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the weaker energy, because it's totally necessary, like in the state of balance. With the yang energy, which is the more masculine energy, which is the active energy. And, you know, we need both of these things. We need the activation, but we also need the rest. And so, this is really a key part of a lot of Eastern philosophies and a lot of Eastern practices. So many people recognize the yin-yang symbol, but how to actually apply that into our lives is something that I really try to encourage through my work, through all stems of my work. So, for example, in the circle last night, we experienced the yin-yang vision. So how do we see, instead of with active eyes, with judgmental eyes, how do we see more with eyes of love? And it's like, you know, we're like radio stations. We can tune into this. We can tune into our more loving selves. And then the same goes for our bodies. So through like my online package, we have a yang class, which is super active, energizing for the body. And this is the thing which like encourages you to take action towards your dreams and your purpose. Like you need this masculine and active energy. But then we have like a wind down class, which is where you melt into, you surrender where life is taking you. So it's really this kind of this useful interplay and weaving together of these two facets of life, which ultimately bring you happiness or peace, rather. I think I'd always promote peace rather than happiness. So, yeah, I think that's my take on the yin-yang. But how did you find the yin-yang practice?
I found it actually surprisingly hard to get into at first, because the object that you asked us to look at an object in the room and to try and bring out the yang and the yin side of it. And I actually looked at my podcast microphone because it was just in front of me. So because it is one of those kind of, I guess it's a gadget, right? So I was finding it hard to get those energies out of it initially. But then when I started to really think about it, I think when we started thinking about the yin side of it, that's when I was able to bring out that more kind of feminine energy. And I was able to, understand what that object means to me and my life. And, you know, it helps me have these conversations such as the one we're having now. It helps me share with the world and facilitate, you know, bringing other ideas to the table and, you know, making other voices heard to an audience. And that's kind of where I was by the end of it. But at first I was just like, oh, it's just a microphone, you know. I don't know if I did the exercise right.
You totally did it right. And actually, some kind of uncomfortableness and some kind of like what's going on and some kind of discomfort is actually always the beginning process of all of these practices. So especially, you know, the ones in person, if we do like the yin-yang vision with each other, it's incredible how kind of, especially living in big cities, how conditioned we are to not look people in the eyes. So often when we do yin-yang vision and we look, you know, I encourage people to look in each other's eyes, there's this huge eruption of laughter because it feels so awkward at first. And then that subsides and you actually melt into the beauty of eye contact and of connection, which is always there underneath that kind of embarrassment, I think, that kind of coats everything. But yeah, that's really what we're trying to delve into. So it's like, you know, it's that layer underneath.
That's so beautiful. And if you start to think about everything in life in that way, I think it all starts to make more sense, I find, because often, especially when I look around my flat, I just feel like I own so many things. And it's actually really nice to acknowledge and like realize that each thing holds an energy, basically, and that it holds a purpose in your life. And also to let go, like that's letting go was such a big theme yesterday that came up for me, which was, you know, letting go of like my older selves, for example, but it can apply to also objects, like being able to let go of things that no longer serve you.
Yeah, Marie Kondo all the way.
Oh yeah, spark and joy.
Yeah, spark and joy. I really need to apply this more into my life because I'm a hugely sentimental person, you know, and I carry a lot of emotional value in things that I have. And one way that I was kind of forced to deal with this was because I mentioned that I was traveling. So for a part of that, all I had was a backpack. And when I first started, you know, the kind that would like collect all the tickets and like, you know, get souvenirs. And I think I did like a week of doing this and like started to feel I can't actually carry all of this stuff on my back. I still got like a year to go. If I keep doing this, I'm literally going to like topple over. Mm-hmm. So this experience taught me like, it's okay actually to have the mental connection to it, like which will never fade, which will, you know, never be lost. So yeah, I had to learn that kind of the hard way on my back. Mm-hmm. I just realised. But yeah, it's nice this year actually to be grounded and to not be living out of the bag or suitcase.
What made you decide to go backpacking?
So I studied law. I studied English law and French law. And I did a year abroad, actually. So I studied at French law school for a year where I just came into contact with people from all over the world. And at that time, Erasmus were doing a grant. So they were really actively encouraging you to experience Europe, which was amazing. So I got to travel a lot there, tasted travel there. And then after I finished my degree, I was kind of like, ooh, I feel like there's more to learn. I felt like I had so many more questions that were not really answered by my education, like life questions, I guess, in the pursuit of knowing that I didn't want to practice law in its traditional form, but exploring the ways that I could. So I embarked on an adventure of working in different projects around the world to kind of test that out. For example, like research projects or working with people. Or working in like larger organizations, smaller organizations, charities, this kind of thing. So the whole thing was just kind of an experiment and a yearn for learning what I wanted to do. And that 1 year turned into like 5 or 6 years somehow. So so just be warned, if you do take like a gap year, it could turn into like a gap long time.
A gap life.
A gap life, yeah.
When you left, you said you were only expecting to go for a year. At any point did you think, oh, I should go back? Or were you kind of just like going with the flow?
Yeah, I was hugely going with the flow. So I was working kind of 3 month blocks, and I just have the next 3 months lined up ahead of time, and it just kept rolling, to be honest. So just kind of one experience led to another, which led to another, which led to another, and yeah, it just kept building like that, to be honest, for the next few years. And my curiosity kind of led me further and further, I suppose. So, you know, there's that old adage that say you know, traveling is addictive, and I think I do see that because it's like this kind of, I always thought that the uncomfortable became the comfortable thing for me. So like kind of always being surrounded by things that were unknown became really normal to me, to the point when I returned back to a sense of total normality or comfort. That was the unusual thing. So it was kind of like reverse culture shock coming back a bit, but super, super appreciate it. I think distance really, you know, it makes the heart grow fonder. So I have a huge appreciation for what we have in the West and what we have grown up with and the freedoms that we have as well that come with that. So yeah, lots of perspective, I guess, is gained in that.
Where did you travel to?
So I started with a job across the US. And this was all solo as well, so after university. And then I went to Ghana for a couple of months for a research project. I lived in Poland for a little while, and then I went to India, and then I did Southeast Asia. That was the backpacking thing. And then I ended up in China for like just 2.5 years, I think. So all of that in total was kind of the sewing together everything. And I came back to England last year.
What were your biggest, I guess, learning points?
Just the kindness of humanity. Like there were times where I just needed help. Like I just didn't know where I was going or what I was doing when I'd arrived in a country, for example. And people would go really out of their way to help me, not being able to speak to me. And, you know, we are almost conditioned and programmed sometimes to think that strangers are dangerous, which is actually a very dangerous conditioning to have, because that experience of being helped by people that I barely knew, that didn't owe me anything, it melted my heart and it opened my heart so much to just the sheer kindness that is out there. So I'd say that's my biggest takeaway from traveling, and yeah, the realization that, you know, we can come from different places and different cultures, but we all essentially have the same hearts. So so it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter language, culture. It's, you know, you see someone that needs help and you help them. So yeah, that's kind of my biggest takeaway, I think.
Definitely, it's something I think about whenever I get into an Uber, for example, because, you know, it's such a weird thing that when growing up, we were just told that, you know, you can't, you know, don't talk to strangers. But we are constantly interacting with strangers without realizing, but because it's so normalized in certain contexts, such as taking an Uber or getting a delivery, why is it that, you know, we're not being murdered left, right, and center by these people? It's because strangers are not actually, they don't tend to be as scary as we're told that they are. But I think it is a defense mechanism, right? It's just, as a parent, you want to make sure when your kid is younger that they don't just go around talking to absolutely anyone, because you can't really trust people. So it's beautiful that you found so much comfort in people who did you ever have a language barrier with them, for example?
All the time, because I was, you know, I would learn as much conversational language as I could, but it, you know, would only take me so far. And other than that, you know, it's incredible how much you can tell from just body language. It just, yeah, body language and energy. Sometimes that's enough communication to, you know, to say thank you and to ask for something, and essentially to respond to needs. Because if you look, you know, if you look at the way that children, like babies, before they have language, they still get their needs met, like in some way, and we respond in energy. And I think even when we have language, we are still doing that consciously or unconsciously. So I wouldn't say that language was a barrier in that way. It just took a more, like I mentioned before, a deeper tuning into a person's body language.
That's such a lovely message as well for anyone who does want to travel and, you know, is maybe afraid of how am I going to communicate with anyone? Because that is always my biggest fear, which is why I've never gone backpacking. And I'm so inspired by you, because I do want to do like a solo thing one day. I wanted to ask you, what was it like traveling as a brown girl, and how did your family react to it?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I don't think I met, I'm trying to recall, but I don't think I met hardly any other brown female solo travelers. I could probably count one or two over the course of 5 years, actually. And yeah, that was quite unusual. I think it's opening up more now. My father's an artist, and he's always had quite an open mind. He did a lot of traveling when he was younger. So I was blessed in the way that I wasn't hindered from doing that. And I was traveling with intent. You know, I was on a real pursuit of exploring. So I think there was faith in, you know, faith in the reason that I was doing it. I think if I had said, oh, I'm just going on holiday for a year, you know, it would have been a different thing. But, you know, there was real purpose and intent and a need for understanding that came behind it. So I would love to encourage, if anyone is listening out there and you've ever thought about traveling alone, it is the least lonely I have ever felt in my entire life when I was traveling alone, because it, you know, it forced me to speak to other people, and other people who are traveling alone equally need to, you know, are looking for people to hang out with. So sometimes you would have these really beautiful brief encounters where you go and see something with someone for a day, and then you may never see them again. You just had that really lovely shared experience of life from wherever they're from and from wherever you're from. And it just, yeah, it totally rolls like this. It just keeps rolling. So, yeah, you know, sometimes you can live in a huge city or a huge university campus surrounded by people and still feel totally lonely. Yet when you're actually alone, you meet lots of people. And that's my experience anyway. So I found that quite interesting, because sometimes cities can be a lonely place, which is quite ironic, I think. What's your take on that?
I agree with you. I think cities can be really lonely, and so I live alone in London, and that, I think, especially during this year, has been quite an interesting journey, because I think on one side people are always like, I don't know how you did it, and I'm kind of like, yeah, but I didn't really have a choice. And on the other hand, you know, I'm being told, well, it was your choice to live alone, but no one would have actually like predicted what would have happened, and that, you know, we'd be in so much isolation, or like in so much in each other's face if, you know, you are living with someone. Also, when you go traveling with friends, or you go with the intention of it's just a vacation, it's very short term, you don't make the effort to actually connect with other people around you, because you have enough interaction already. So I found that, I mean, it's the smallest thing, but a few months ago I was sitting in a cafe just down the road, and for like one of the few times I hadn't taken my phone. So I was literally just sitting outside with my coffee, just watching people. And in 2020, that is very creepy, because nobody does that. Everyone's got their face in their phone, right? And this man who was sitting on the table next to me started talking to me, not in a creepy way, but it was just kind of like, I don't even know what he struck up a conversation about. And we ended up just chatting for like 45 minutes. And that has not happened to me. Like in London, that just doesn't happen. So I thought that was astounding. And it was the fact that my energy was receptive to that person, which it wouldn't have been had my phone, you know, been in my hand. So yeah, that's definitely something I want to experience, which is why solo travel seems so interesting. And it's, again, it's inspiring, because genuinely most people don't do it. And it's because of the fear that's so ingrained in us, that something's going to happen to you. You're a young woman, you won't be able to protect yourself, you know, people are just there to take advantage of you. And all of us have watched scary films like Taken and, you know, all that. And so did you have any resistance from your family or friends when you were away? Were they ever concerned about your safety?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, parents would always be, they'd always be concerned, because you're away from them. But yeah, I suppose it's just a case of checking in and faith, I guess, just faith, I think. And, you know, I would just be as street aware as possible. And I suppose the thing that it does is set you on a course of intuition. And so you have to really tune into, does this situation feel right? Do I feel safe? If you don't, for even a second, you get that feeling in your stomach, you remove yourself from the situation. And if you can, you know, and try to do it before you actually get to that. But I suppose that's the thing with putting yourself outside the comfort zone, is that you are constantly encountered with these chances to meet your intuition. Whereas sometimes when we have like a carved, like routine life, which I've also had, you know, with work and kind of following the same patterns, that sometimes we don't get to meet that deeper rooted intuition that asks us to make decisions like that. So yeah, again, it's another form of schooling. It's another form of practice. And yeah, it's nice kind of being able to listen to another part of your body other than your head sometimes. Like, stomach is so powerful. I think it has the second amount of like neuroreceptors or something is your brain, so it's, you know, it's hugely beneficial to listen to it when we can.
Yeah, it's so true, because I think the culture we live in sort of this, I don't know, capitalist society or whatever, it's like you have to use your brain. You know, your brain is going to tell you what you need to do, and you have to think logically, but actually your gut is so powerful. And I found my gut has always been right. No matter, you know, how much I try to ignore it sometimes, if I don't want to listen to it because I don't agree with what it's saying, or because it's uncomfortable or requires some sort of, you know, very uncomfortable change to happen, you find sooner or later, like you do realize you have to sort of succumb to that, that message. And actually, because we're so, you know, we think we're so protected as well, in this sort of, yeah, in just the big city life, that it's more like your natural human instincts start to come out when you're in that situation, on the kind of situations you've been in. I mean, again, I'm saying this off the top of my head. I haven't experienced it that much myself, but that's what's so fascinating, is that actually we all have that voice inside us telling us what's right and what's wrong, and just being able to recognize those.
Absolutely. And I've found sometimes when I walk into the fire that I fear the most, realized that it wasn't fire at all, and it was just like this, you know, conditioning and this idea that I had. I see this all the time where I'm like, oh, I need to have this conversation, I'm worried about having this conversation, and then I do it, and it takes like a month to build up to it, for example, and then I do it and I'm like, oh, it was not as bad as I thought.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and I think the same applies to just most things that we fear, actually. It's like just walking straight into them. Just walk straight into them, you'll realise it's not as bad. It's not as bad as we think it is.
Yeah.
Generally on the other side, people are kind. Yeah, generally on the other side, people are kind. So.
Mm. Do you think that fear comes from a lack of faith?
I think perhaps fear comes from a lack of practice. So, you know, and that stems back to, like, early psychology as well has shown kind of our early patterns of whether we were allowed to go out to play and explore versus if we were parented or our primary caretakers were quite protective of us, then those are patterns that we carry with us into our adulthood. So, you know, sometimes it's what we're given, but then as adults we get the choice to say, okay, so this is what I was given now. Do I want to go on an adventure? Do I have to come into contact with this kind of this feeling in myself? But we all have the ability to transform it, I think. Mm-hmm. So, we don't get a choice of what we grow up with, but we do get a choice of where we're going with it.
Mm-hmm. So powerful, because we forget that we have that power. Going back to your travels, do you have an interesting story that you can share, maybe, or something crazy that happened to you?
Oh, there's so many. I suppose one of my most memorable trips is the Philippines, which is 2017. And this was a trip where I booked a flight and nothing else. And a friend that I had met in India joined me there also. And I turned up to the airport and they had a tent, and I was like, what's that tent for? And they were like, I don't know, it just might be useful. What we were doing actually then is that we hadn't researched anything. We literally hitchhiked our way around the Philippines for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Catching different boats, getting on the back of different trucks, ending up in the most beautiful pieces of paradise that, yeah, just totally blew my mind. Again, things that I would never see if I had put planning into place. So I guess that's another test of faith. You know, there was one time where we ended up in this, it was like a natural hot spring. It started raining. There was beautiful tropical stuff everywhere. And I was just thinking, this can't be real. Like, this can't be real. How can I be here?
Yeah.
And it's so interesting because I spent hardly anything at all during that trip because we were sleeping on beaches, we had a tent, and we were hitchhiking. So there was, you know, sometimes you think that money will buy us so much happiness, but actually some of the most enriching experiences I've had have been the ones where I hardly spend anything at all. That's a big lesson in that, I think. And yeah, again, testing that intuition, do I want to get in this car with this person? But you know, actually, then I came back to England, and that summer I was going to a festival, and for some reason, so I had to get out because I needed to go to the bathroom, there was traffic, and my friend got moved on, I was with another friend, and she got moved on down the motorway, and in my head I thought, oh, it's okay, I'll just like put my thumb out, someone going to the festival will help us, we're like two girls with nothing, what's the harm? And nobody in England picked us up, so we ended up walking for like 2 hours or something to get to this festival through fields. And I thought, well, this is just the huge difference between the East and the West, because again, we're conditioned by fear of other human beings. And there, it just wasn't a thing. You just help other people where you can. Huge contrasts.
In a lot of these episodes, the idea of the East versus the West comes up. And everyone seems to touch on it in some way or another, because there is this idea of like in the East, we are a lot more sort of collectivist, and in the West, we're more individualistic. And that I feel like comes out in experiences like these, where you see, you know, complete strangers are just, they find it completely normal to help someone they don't know. And over here, there's probably a fear on both ends, because the drivers will be like, oh, you know, what if this person tries to, you know, attack me or something? And the other way around, where people who might need a ride might hesitate. So it's just such a cultural barrier. I find that so, so interesting. Was that something that was normal to you before you went traveling, or was it only normalized once you'd had that experience?
No. I mean, I would never have done that in England, because it's just like not something that was ever even really on my radar. It just, it happened when I opened myself up to the possibilities of it happening when I was traveling. I wanted to bring it back to the East versus West debate, and how in the East it's kind of known that you act as a collective. But the thing is, I think growing up as a South Asian in the West is that we do still have the values of growing up as a collective, but we're suddenly in the West. I saw something on social media that said, you know, in the office space, when you grow up in South Asian culture and you're taught the kind of, you know, the opinion and the feelings of everyone is really important, and then you're put into a corporate environment which is a lot more individual, there can be a lot of resistance about that. And sometimes I've certainly felt this. I felt that I couldn't raise my voice, or I couldn't be heard, because I was so used to putting kind of a collective action or agreement in place from how our culture is taught. I think that might be something that's shared across, you know, this unusual but very usual way of living up in two societies at once.
Yeah. Do you think there's a right or wrong?
No, I don't think there's a right or wrong necessarily. I think that there should be an integration. It's like pieces of a puzzle, and it's kind of working out which bits do I take and which bits do I leave. which is essentially the mixing pot of growing up in two cultures at once.
Yeah, the idea of picking and choosing, I think, is very relatable for almost all of us, because we've sort of been shoved in a situation where we've had to do that, you know, because the two are so contradictory sometimes, or, you know, so contrasting that you have to pick one side or the other, depending on what the scenario is. I don't know, it could be something as simple as moving out for university. I think there's still a lot of households where, you know, the parents would encourage the children to live at home because they want to be around them and they want to make sure they come home at a decent time. And it's this idea of, okay, do you flee the nest before, say, you get married? Or do you kind of succumb to it and you just sort of, you know, work with it and you still go to university, but, you know, you come back at 7 o'clock at night and, you know, you don't hang out with your friends after a certain point. So, I mean, I don't know if it's the best example, but yeah, it's just one of those things that we've just been put into that position as the diaspora. And I don't know if that is something that, you know, the younger gen are going to be able to relate to going forward, because maybe they don't have to make these choices the way that we've had to. So I think we're a very unique generation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you're so right with that. I love how you articulated that. We are that middle link between between both. We are literally the middle because, yeah, the next generation will have our understanding passed on to them of both, but there will still be an understanding of here. whereas our parents have, they have the understanding that they grew up with as well. So I don't think any one of them can be blamed because we can only teach like what we have been given. I've seen a huge, I suppose, rejection of our culture growing up in the West, which I think is a real shame because there is so much beauty and so many incredible tools for living peacefully and harmoniously that we can take from our culture. It's interesting now because it's kind of being repackaged and sold as this like mindfulness and just different words for the things that our parents have been doing the whole time. Just because it's being sold by perhaps Western companies and it's becoming like a cooler thing, you know, it's kind of making a comeback. But it's all tools that we've all had all along. It's just sometimes it's just asking why. And I think sometimes kind of growing up with like a lot of the traditions and the cultures and the ceremonies and stuff, I didn't really understand why, which is why I didn't really take too much interest or practice them. And it's only like as I've grown older and taken more of an interest and understood, oh, this is why we do this, oh, this is what it brings me, that I'm like, I want to take this forwards and I want to teach my children this. Because if we don't, then it's lost.
Yeah. On the topic of cultural appropriation, what comes to mind is turmeric lattes and haldi dool, and how my mum used to make me drink that whenever I was feeling ill. And now you go to a cafe and you spend £4 on one of those things. And it's just like, what is happening? Like, it's so funny almost because it just seems so ridiculous sometimes because we still adhere to it. Like, I will still pay £4 for a turmeric latte, even though I know my mum makes it at home for like 20p or something. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's part of this kind of wider awakening that, this wider awakening and this return to nature that's happening, you know, like veganism has risen, it's exponentially, like the thoughts of and practices of like earth being our healing and all the resources and stuff like that. So I think there is wider awakening, but it is strange because it's like, this was not a thing like 5 years ago. So it's quite interesting to see that now. But it's very beautiful feeling culture being embraced, actually. We're very lucky to have that, I think. There are lots of cultures that are like very unseen. So to see our culture, like you said, going to a normal Starbucks and see something that my mum used to make when I was 5. That's nice that we can have that.
As a, as a yoga and tantra practitioner and a teacher, what are your thoughts on cultural appropriation around those practices?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point. I suppose it follows on from the previous thing, that it's beautiful that these tools and techniques are being spread because people will be helped by them. But what I wish and I hope for is that, you know, this science of yoga and tantra, they took generations and centuries and centuries and centuries to build. And I hope that people who teach them and facilitate them and also practice them can credit where they stemmed from and the teachers that dedicated their lives to creating this life-enhancing and life-transforming art. And I think what the shame is that sometimes just pieces of these practices are being taken out of their original context and then kind of repurposed, repackaged and sold. For example, that's why tantra has such a strange connotation in the West. So what I think really needs to happen is the whole picture needs to be seen. And we need to be credited, where the practices are being used by practitioners in the West. And then the third thing is that it needs to turn from appropriation, so taking something out of context and profiting from it, to appreciation. So taking something, fully understanding it, crediting where it comes from, and sharing it. I don't think there's a problem with sharing. I want this practice to be shared as much as possible. But just with that framework, I think. And I feel like I would have found these practices so much sooner if I had seen more people who looked like me facilitating and teaching them. And I go to a lot of the yoga studios in London and I don't see anyone that looks like me. And it's strange being South Asian and coming from this culture, yet going to a studio and not seeing anyone that looks like me or that I can relate to, but teaching me something about my culture. So sometimes I think this is a shared thing, and it's a big part of my purpose and my mission to just welcome back South Asians to this part of their heritage, because it's yours. It's already yours. It's in your DNA. You've practiced it before somewhere. Yeah. And the thing about these practices is that when you come back to them, they feel so, even if you've not practiced them now, like they feel so grounding, because somewhere in your lineage, they would have existed. So a real sense of homecoming and grounding.
Actually, with yoga, I always find that, again, it's a weird one because I've not really taken the time to practice it maybe outside this context of like repackaging and being taught to me. So any experience I've had with yoga has been, you know, non-Indian instructors. And sometimes you think it's really strange that they're, you know, telling you names that are, you know, you recognize them in your own language. And they're pronounced kind of differently, you know, by these instructors, and you just think it's a really strange feeling. You touched on transforming cultural appropriation to appreciation. What do you think needs to happen in London or, you know, in the West to make sure that these practices are, you know, communicated to us in the correct way?
I think that we need to go to the source, and I think that South Asian teachers need to be given the credit that they're due, not just for going on a 200-hour training or 300-hour training, because this doesn't make you a teacher. It's actually a lifetime of understanding a culture that you transmit to your students. So an understanding of dharma, of working with purpose, an understanding of meditation, of growing up with parents who sing mantras, of growing up with grandparents who you see meditating every single day, of eating an Ayurvedic diet with Ayurvedic spices. You know, this is an all-encompassing culture and life practice, a life philosophy. So I think that studios in London would hugely benefit from embracing South Asian teachers, whether they are British Asian or whether they are teachers that are brought from India, who can really beautifully transmit the practice. And the reason why I use transmit is because it's not only the things that you say, it's not only the instructions that you give, but it's being in the presence of someone that comes from that land. So I would always, always recommend this, and I would always recommend practicing with a teacher that you know has trained in the homeland of, you know, of the practice, because they will have received a transmission from all of the people who have practiced in that land when they were training there. So it goes much, much deeper than something that you dip in and out of. You're receiving the energy of that person. Yeah, I think it's really important. And yeah, just going back to crediting the ancestors who poured life, work, and understanding to creating this for us. Mm-hmm.
This is why I think the work that you're doing is so important, because you're actually trying to connect these practices that are so appropriated to their roots. And I think that's such a noble thing. And I think more people need to be aware of, you know, of the importance of doing this. So thank you for your work that you're doing. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your transition into this life that you're living now. So you said that you studied law, and can you tell me a little bit more about what you did after university and what sparked you to pursue this life and kind of, you know, carve your own path?
This is a really important conversation to have, because I feel like it's one that's shared a lot with certainly the South Asian pressures to do certain kinds of, to pursue certain career paths. And for me, it's interesting because I carried with me this sense that I had to do law for some reason, even though my parents never told me to. I like carried it from, I think, societal expectations that this is a good career and that money will mean happiness. And, you know, and this was just the way to do life, like school, university, work, house, kids. And I had done that. So I had got a good degree. I had got a good job. I had got a good flat in a good city with a good status. And I found myself at the end of this being like, wow, I don't feel happy. And I thought, why is this? And, you know, it had really got to the point where I'd stopped listening to the needs and the desires and the wants of my body and my purpose and my soul, because I was listening so much to my head and what I thought I should be doing. And it got to the point where, yeah, my body had turned off and I'd become completely numb. I was totally numb. I couldn't feel anything. And I thought, I can't do this anymore. So I rang my parents. And again, this is one of the conversations that I thought was going to be one of the most difficult conversations of my life. And I literally planned it out like a lawyer. And I wrote down all of the different points that I was going to make to my parents, with all of the backup points and all of the possible options that I could have afterwards, like literally like point to point. And yeah, I say that this is probably the most important case that I ever made in my life, in my law life, because it was the case for my life. When I spoke to my parents, they were like, "But Neta, we never told you you have to do this." And I was like, "What? Oh, yeah." And walking into that fire and suddenly realizing actually all they wanted was that I should be happy.
Mm.
And with that blessing, then I took this path. But I suppose I want to make it clear that it wasn't an overnight thing. So I set up, I suppose, for 2 to 3 years whilst I was working. I was teaching at the same time. So I was teaching corporate programs and getting an understanding of, you know, the work pressures and how I could solve those with Eastern practices.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it wasn't like dropping everything. It was building confidence bit by bit and knowing like, okay, this is going to work. I can do this. And then feeling at the time then when I needed it that I could drop it. So it's like almost like there was this preparation happening long before I realized that it wasn't my path, you know. So yeah, I would say if there is anyone out there that is feeling like this, that is feeling like I'm not living authentically, this isn't what I feel like I was meant to feel like when I achieved all of these things, I'd say just start exploring what makes you feel alive. And when you come into contact with those things, keep practicing them and keep practicing them until you feel the confidence that now it's your time. And sometimes, like, I say keep practicing, but sometimes you just have to rip off the band-aid and be like, okay, now it's time. Now I can't do this anymore. Now yeah. I have to live for me. So, yeah, that's kind of the transition that I took anyway.
At what point did you know you had to rip off that band-aid? Because I think there's always that little leap of faith you'll have to take at some point.
Yeah, so there was a natural transition of my contracts coming to an end. At which point, you know, there was a chance for a renewal, but there was also an opportunity for change. And I was tapping into how miserable and how sensationless I was feeling. And to be honest, that was really where I knew that I needed to change something. And that's where my much deeper dive into the tantric practice arrived, because I needed to bring my body back online.
Yeah.
So, that's where I was already teaching yoga, but that's where my spiritual and my tantric practice came in to heal my body from all of the ignoring that I had been doing.
So many people are going to resonate with this feeling and this fear of not knowing when to take that leap of faith, because What I loved when we initially spoke about this on the phone was that we spoke about it like a breakup with your salary and your security. And I loved that idea because I think especially living in a place like a big city where, you know, rent is high, you need to be able to have an income constantly every month to just make ends meet or like live the lifestyle that you want. It's very interesting that there's such a culture now of side hustles. I have side hustles and it's because I know I can't break up with my salary, because if you do, then what? Like, yeah. You know, then the only thing you can fall back on is the stuff that you enjoy and love. But what if you stop loving it because of that? So what I want to ask you, as someone who has sort of made it to the other side, do you have any regrets?
No. I can say an astounding no. I don't have any regrets, and I think that it was a case of walking through that fire and realizing on the other side that it was okay. Because I also said this when I was working my corporate job, and people said, "Why don't you just teach yoga full time or do this full time?" And I thought, "Oh no, I wouldn't want to put that kind of pressure on something I love, because you know then I won't love it anymore." And that hasn't happened at all, actually. So from experience, I love it even more. And it's actually, you know, it's allowed me to deepen my practice tenfold, because this is what I live and do now. And yeah, with regards to the salary, when I left my corporate job and I broke up with my salary, I realized that it is one of the most addictive things that we have in our lives. Like, forget coffee, forget cigarettes, forget alcohol. Our salaries are one of the most addictive things in our lives. Because, you know, in some senses, they can be like an abusive relationship where we keep going back to the things that make us unhappy, but we're seduced by the things that they give us, which are like short-term happiness, you know, which allow us to perpetuate the cycle that we're already in. And that's very scary. And it's also very scary breaking up with that, because you're kind of like, oh my God, this is all I've ever been used to. How will I manage? And then you realize like loads of people are doing this actually, and there is another way to live life. And also I suppose with that is sacrifice. And if you look at the word sacrifice, it's to give something up, to get yourself closer, to bring yourself closer to something more sacred. So for me, that element of sacrifice was giving up the status. It was giving up the apartment. It was giving up the city life. It was moving home. And those are all things I had to sacrifice to bring myself closer to something more sacred, which is living dharma, which is living purpose. And I think this is, I didn't realize this until recently, but it is definitely a part of the process.
That's so deep, and I think it's just super brave. Like, if I were to think about it, I think it's like anyone who does make that change and that sacrifice, I think it really needs a lot of intention and consciousness of why you're making that decision. Because it might be that you are, you know, there will be a ripple effect and your lifestyle will change, your friendships might change because of it. And it's this thing we were speaking about in the circle yesterday, which is letting go of things to make space for the new. And it's because the new is so just unknown, and we fear the unknown always, that we like holding on to abusive things that make us unhappy, because we know the amount of pain it's giving us, and that's okay. It's like, I'll deal with that for the rest of my life because it's not the unknown.
Yeah, absolutely. The unknown is always scary. It's like dipping your toe into it. You have to keep dipping your toe into it, and then like a pool, and testing it. Yeah, I've just lost my train of thought totally.
That's all right. That happens.
Totally lost my train of thought. But there were a lot of calculations that I did before I made the choice. Like, there's a few frameworks online which kind of keep making you deduce to what the worst case situation would be. Like, if I did this, this would be the worst case situation. But if I stayed in what I'm doing now, then I won't change at all, you know. And it's kind of doing all of these, doing all of this kind of internal work and understanding. And actually, this is when I found the Women's Circle. So it was during my transition from my corporate life into what I do now. And it was huge. I suddenly had this twice a month check-in where I was able to reflect on, oh my gosh, this is something I need to change. Oh, hang on. Okay, if I let go of this, then I have space for this. And not only that, but I was surrounded by like minds who were also doing this. So the Women's Circle helped me hugely to understand and to do the inner work to make the transition, if that makes sense.
It's almost like you can't just get up one day and make that transition. Like, you need these pillars of support. And would you say that the Women's Circle was that for you?
Yeah, the Women's Circle was absolutely that for me. And, you know, actually the circles that I went to, I was going to them in China, and there wasn't a sharing in those circles. So it was all internal work, but actually just carving out like 2 hours every 2 weeks during the lunar cycle, like coming back to nature, taking time to rest and reflect, was the changing point, I think, in my life. Because otherwise I would have just kept going on as normal. And time just goes by like that if we don't stop and reflect.
Gosh, that's so true. Like, we all know it, but do we all really do it? Like, I'm one of these people who's very hyper aware of, you know, I have to be, you know, journaling works for me. I should be doing that, but I don't constantly do it because life just gets in the way sometimes. I feel like the circle yesterday, I didn't know how much I needed it, because I think the past few weeks I've had like a really, really busy time at work, and just sitting with my thoughts and just reflecting and also letting energies go, I think was so, so needed. And when you do it, oh, you feel like a release. It's almost like getting a massage.
Yeah.
You just don't know how much you need it until you see that release and feel it.
Yeah. So, yeah, we just don't know how much we're holding on to because we don't pause to see it. So it's just, I suppose the circle is about, it's about holding space for women to look within themselves and feel the support, you know, where we may not get that support from even our closest network, but feeling the support to be the most authentic, truthful version of yourself. Like, it's so raw. Sometimes, you know, this is the first time that a woman has been able to speak her most authentic self. And it's so beautiful seeing transitions sometimes where women in perhaps the first circle they come to may barely be able to speak through their tears, and seeing like a few circles later that they are like these beautiful, magnificent goddesses that emerge and that can speak so confidently. And yeah, this is the power of sitting with women and not seeing each other as our competition, but seeing each other you know, as our support network and as our sisters. This is a huge part of healing that circle offers.
What I loved was when you said at the start as well that, you know, back in the day, women used to meet in circles, and that it's such an ancient practice and common thing among human beings that we no longer do because of the world we live in. I think sitting with other women yesterday, I just felt like it's almost like, you know, your intuition. I don't know if it's my intuition, but I just felt like I was home, like I was doing something that I always knew how to do, but I just hadn't done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it felt familiar.
Yeah, and I love this, because this is, like I said, this is this ancient part of you that remembers that this is, it's safe here, you know, it's safe to let go here, it's safe to do what you need to do, it's safe to be vulnerable here. And yeah, it's beautiful seeing this revival of sisterhood, because growing up sometimes in a patriarchal society, again, the masculine driven society, the individualist society, eliminate sometimes this sense of community and gathering and trust in others. So yeah, so the sense of returning to that does feel like a homecoming. It really, really does. And also aligning with nature. So the circle is always held around the full moon and new moon, which in our evolutionary history are times when we would have taken rest, certainly around the new moon for women, which when we would have been living in tribes, because there was no light in darkest skies at night, right, for new moon, that women would retreat into their tents or their houses together. And because their bodies would be in a state of rest, this would be also the time that they would receive their bleed. So they would take this kind of heightened hormonal state and sew together their experiences and reflections and support. And how beautiful is that? You know, how beautiful is that to really have the sense of community? Because there's huge studies that have shown the number one contributor to our well-being is not what we eat, it's not how we exercise, but it's our sense of community. So the more we feel a part of something, the more happier we are, the more motivated we are, the more purposeful we are. So, yeah, I think that's the sense that we get when we gather with each other.
What about people who consider themselves to be introverts? Does it still apply regardless of your personality type?
Totally, totally. I welcome absolutely everyone, and there is no pressure to do anything that you don't want to do. For example, your spirit and your heart can be totally opened just by receiving the wisdom of other women. And in the circle, you know, I mentioned that every single woman is drawn there for a reason. So sometimes what you share in circle may be for someone else, even if perhaps you are an introvert and you may not feel like you want to share anything, you will still do your inner work, you will still receive, and you will still reflect. And so I'd say the circle is a place where every single part of every single woman is welcome and accepted to be exactly as they are.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I also found was that you said we were experiencing almost like the highest form of Tantra. And I know that Tantra, you've also previously mentioned, is very misunderstood, or like only one facet of it, which is, I guess, the sexual aspect of it, or is it the sensual aspect that's misunderstood? I guess, what is Tantra, essentially, is my question. And why is it so misunderstood?
Yeah, really good question. So Tantra is essentially, it means weaving, and it's the weaving together of multidisciplinary approaches. So it came around in India at a time where it was quite a revolutionary thought and a revolutionary practice, because it swept away some of the things such as the gender imbalances, for example, that women couldn't be priests, that religion and spirituality was reserved for only the highest castes, and it replaced it with these practices which could be practiced by the masses, by women who could be spiritual teachers. So it's revolutionary in its thoughts and its practice. And I think where the misunderstanding comes is that in Tantra we work with sexual energy, which is different from working with sex. So this is where the confusion comes. The sexual and sensual energy is the Kundalini energy, which lives at the base of the spine, which through a series of meditations, yoga, mantra, and these multidisciplinary practices is released. And this is our creative energy. This is our sensual energy. This is the energy that can drive us to pursue our purpose. So it is hugely misconceived, but I think that's where we tap into this drawing back to really practicing it within ourselves first. I think where sometimes in the West it seems like you need a partner to practice Tantra, no. you can practice Tantra in your own body through opening up your own energetic senses. To live more openly and to live more at one with everything that you come into contact with.
And how has practicing Tantra then made you approach your own life?
When I finished my first training in Tantra, I didn't realize that my relationships would transform around me, not by having conversations with people who perhaps I didn't understand at first, or the people that I thought, oh, we're just different kinds of people. And those were the relationships which totally transformed, because I stopped seeing them as differences and I started seeing them in their essence. So again, it's this case of kind of looking underneath the surface of a person and seeing yourself as that person and seeing themselves as you. And everything is a divine reflection in the Vedic philosophy. So everyone is a lesson, and everyone is essentially a mirror for ourselves. So I think this was one of the most revolutionary parts of the practice, and this deeper connection with myself, with my body, with my intuition, has allowed me to guide the rest of my life. You know, like a little sat nav. Like a little sat nav for my life. It's guided now more by my energetic senses rather than by my head and perhaps the conditioning that I was following previously.
Wow, that's so powerful, because most of us try and navigate without sat nav. I think like an inner compass.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can't function without Google Maps, so I think my life also needs that direction. So that's so cool that you've kind of transformed that into something that you use to direct you, because I think a lot of it is why so many of us are unhappy, inherently not content, because we're sort of going around in circles, or we don't really have direction. We're sort of just reacting to everything. And there's so much power in sort of being a lot more grounded and aligned.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I always draw it back to it's a total practice. So mm-hmm. I really love the way that there's this theme of sat nav and maps and stuff, because I wonder if I also use Google Maps religiously, actually. And I think now, maybe if I just trusted my intuition a little bit and tried to remember, like playing with the sensation in my stomach, oh, this feels like the right turn. Oh, okay, I'll take it. Then we would also create a pattern, wouldn't we? We'd create a pattern where it comes to the bigger decisions in our lives. Oh, this feels right. I'm going to take this turn. I'm going to take this decision. So it starts with these kind of smaller practices, because, Thunder is a life philosophy. So it evolves and it evokes in every single waking moment that we experience. And yeah, once you experience it, it multiplies and it keeps applying to different areas. So I'd say if you're interested in Tantra, it's always been experienced through lineages. So Tantra is a lineage based practice which is passed through teachers and through experience. It's always said that it's not essentially something that can be read in the book. So sometimes I get questions, I want to learn about Tantra, which book should I read? And I say, like, read your body and find a teacher. Because this is how we learn. It's a different kind of knowledge.
Learning by practicing, which again is like, it goes back to the idea of our roots, and that's how people, you know, back in the day used to learn, and it's just by practicing, and rather than, you know, just sitting in your indoors just reading about something and not actually taking that and putting it into practice.
Yeah, and learning through stories, like learning through stories from our grandparents and people who are older than us and people who are around us. I wish we just told stories more and held space for this. So I think that's also another good way of educating.
That's such a beautiful place to wrap up, I think. And I have one final question for you, Henneke. What do you have strong game in? And what could you have stronger game in?
Oh, I wish I thought about this before now. I do have strong game in applying creativity to all facets of my life. I could have stronger game in my more masculine energy, which is like the action-driven energy. So I think, again, it's bringing it back to this polarity of being supercharged in my feminine energy and seeking more work in my masculine action-taking energy.
I love that and how aware of it you are. I think if we're taking it back to the yin and yang, definitely the more action-driven aspect of it is also lacking for me. So I'm glad you said that, because I think I'm the same. I'm like a huge thinker. And then when it comes to doing, I just get crippled with nervousness and not sure how to start.
Yeah, it's something that is shared, I think, by so many of us. It's like having ideas and it's like, okay, now let's execute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one more thing I wanted to say was, is it common for, I guess, for people who identify as male to have more masculine energy, more of the yang, and for more females to have the more yin, or is there no correlation?
No, actually, we all have masculine and feminine energy within us, and it's about finding the balance of both within us so that we can both have inspiration, intuition, and creativity through the feminine, and courage, action, and discipline to do them through the masculine. So it's about practicing both of them within us. So men equally benefit from tapping into their feminine energy as well, which is, yeah, again, it's a huge practice for all of us to do that. And this is where, if we were to practice Tantra with a partner, where our partners can be our spiritual teachers, because we can interweave our feminine with their masculine and find a blissful union between us through this.
That's amazing. And I think that's such a nice takeaway, because it's so easy to stereotype as well. And just remembering that we all have both elements in us is, I think, a really powerful thing. So thank you so much for sharing. And thank you for coming on. It's been such a pleasure chatting to you. I feel like I've learned a lot from you. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me on here and for connecting me with your beautiful listeners. And yeah, I hope to stay connected with you and with anyone who's interested in learning more about the ancient Indian arts and reconnecting with these beautiful life-enhancing practices.
I love that. Thank you for all your work, Kenneka, and I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.